www.bigradio.com. Pay us a visit if you can. Billy Shears, many thanks to Billy Shears, our music director, and to the Head On Radio Network. And don't forget, you've heard from the radical right. Now all that's left is the truth. Stay tuned for Mark. He's coming up next.
And now, from Washington, the Inside Scoop. All the news the government does not want you to hear. Now, here's your host on the Inside Scoop, Mark Levine.
Good evening, America. Welcome to the Inside Scoop. Well, it is official. Of course, I've been saying it for a couple months now. Clearly, Barack Obama is the Democratic nominee. It became official last night, and I do think it's important to sit back and reflect a bit, even though, yes, by this point we all knew it was happening, and yes, even though Hillary Clinton hasn't quite conceded yet, it's important to recognize what just happened. A guy by the name of Barack Obama, someone who'd been in the Senate just a few years, but someone who had inspired us all in 2004. In fact, I first said he should run for president after his speech before the Democratic National Convention in 2004. Barack Obama has become the Democratic nominee for President of the United States. Now, obviously, everyone is going on about the historicness, and it is historic, of a black man becoming the first black man to be a major party nominee. Well, first of all, obviously, Obama is half black. That's not talked about too much. But it is indeed historic, and I think one should never underestimate the feeling that any minority has, but particularly African Americans, in feeling left out by history, by America, by, the way the world works. Look, no minority, with the possible exception of Native Americans. Okay, I'll give them the exception. After all, we took their land and wiped out 90% of their people. But with the exception of Native Americans, no one has been more mistreated than African Americans, than descendants of slaves in America. After slavery, of course, there was Jim Crow. Blacks really didn't get full rights, even under the law, much less, rights of people hiring them in jobs and so forth, which still don't exist in racism today. But they didn't even get full rights under the law until the 1960s. And the whole thing is I find kind of fascinating, given that Obama is not an African-American in the sense that we think of as African-Americans. I mean, it's interesting, even the term African-American, Obama is more African-American than most African-Americans. After all, his father was African. His mother was an American, white American from Kansas, raised in Hawaii and Indonesia and elsewhere. And yet, the great majority of African-Americans are not from newly arrived free immigrants from Africa. Of course, they are descendants of slaves. And it's fascinating to me because even though Barack Obama does not share that heritage, it is still seen by blacks and whites alike as an historic attempt to finally turn the page in history. I mean, if you look at the emotional reaction of African Americans, it's this feeling that now there's no more ceiling, that maybe this time we've made it. And of course, that says too much and it says too little. I mean, it says too much because racism still exists. There still will be trouble with black people getting jobs from white people, because most people who hire people for jobs hire people they know. We don't have a meritocracy in America. I wish we did. If we did, the Head On Radio Network would be on every single radio station in America, because we are simply better than any other talk radio channel in America. So we don't have a meritocracy. This is a country that hires based on who you know. And given that people do hire their uncles, cousins, friends, brother who they went to college with, it's still much harder for an African-American, a descendant of slaves, to get a decent shake in America than a white person. And that will remain the case even if, as hope, pray, and dream, Barack Obama becomes president of the United States. But yet, I do think we've crossed a line here. Obviously, the line will be crossed if he becomes president, but even becoming a major party nominee, I think the line is that for some African Americans, and I think of Pastor Jeremiah Wright, for example, in this category, and some of the many who listened to me when I was on XM satellite radio on Radio 1, the African American channel, The Power, for too many, they only focused on the systemic racism in America, which none of us can deny exists. But they never focused on the individual power of individuals to rise above their circumstances. 100 years ago, W.B. Du Bois, the first African-American Harvard PhD, wrote in The Souls of Black Folk that a talented tenth of, then he called them Negroes, a talented tenth of black people could rise above any circumstance, no matter how harsh the racism. And I think that may have been true in his day. Maybe he was a bit optimistic. Today, it is, well, a majority, I would say, can rise above their circumstances. Now, there's still a significant minority living in poverty, living in ghettos, living in a systemic racist culture. But what the rise of Barack Obama shows is that, yes, yes, Du Bois's dream is alive and well. The American dream is alive and well. And while racism still exists, there is power to rise from a single mother, poor family, to becoming president of the United States. Indeed, Bill Clinton showed that power when he did the same thing. I've always felt, whatever you think about Bill Clinton and particularly how he and Hillary have conducted themselves over the last few months, whatever you think of him, you've got to be proud of the fact that he rose from the humblest of upbringings to become president of the United States. And that, to me, is part of the magic of America. America, where it's not always George W. Bush, son of George Bush, a person who was so drunk and high on cocaine, but because he was a son of a president, he could get pushed into Yale, even though he obviously didn't merit it based on grades. There is no question a part of America that helps the scions of powerful families, people like George W. Bush, people like Dan Quayle, people like some of the younger Kennedys who didn't make it based on their particular intelligence or speech-giving capability or charisma, but based solely on their name. That exists in America. But there is an American dream as well. And that's what Barack Obama shows. And those Americas, John Edwards might call them those two Americas, are always in tension. And you'll find, I think, among some of the worst pessimists and skeptics of the left, a denial that the second America exists. The worst skeptics on the left will say to you that it's all about who you know, that it's all about your name, that it's all about being a sign of the rich and powerful, and there is no more American dream. To those skeptics on the left, I think Barack Obama showed they're wrong. And then there's the right, and the right argues exactly the opposite. That America is entirely a meritocracy, that it's not about science of the rich, that it's about entirely the American dream, and all you have to do is pull yourself up by your bootstraps. And to them, I throw the example of George W. Bush and Dan Quayle, who did not succeed based on any talent, but based solely on who their daddy was. So there are two Americas, and the extreme right is wrong, and the extreme left is wrong. There is hope. Barack Obama personifies that hope. And there is systemic power in racism. George W. Bush, I think, exemplifies that. And so, I don't know, call me a moderate on this. I see optimism and pessimism. I see hope and opportunity, as well as I see corruption and an engrafted legacy by the current government. And when Barack Obama talks about change, I think in essence that's what he's talking about. He's talking about that idea. That change that really goes back to the oldest founding ideals of America as the American dream, as a land where anyone can succeed, as a land where all men and women are created equal, even though the author of that phrase, Thomas Jefferson, really only meant to include Christian white men with property. So, again, I, as always, I'm looking one foot in the past and one foot in the future. I'm looking, wondering, hoping, praying that Barack Obama will become president of the United States. And yet I'm worried. I'm worried. Hey, you can't be a liberal without being worried. I'm worried. I'm worried about racism in America. I'm worried about people in, sorry, Bob, in Bob Kincaid's home state of West Virginia and the neighboring state of Kentucky and my home state of Tennessee, frankly, where I worry that there are a number of people, poor white people. Let's give the name. Let's talk about who we're talking about. Not just poor white people, rich white people. I'm worried about white people. A few, well, or larger than a few, group of ignorant white people who just won't vote for a man who is half black. Now, 20% of West Virginians, 25% of Kentuckians in the Democratic primary, this doesn't include the Republicans, this doesn't include the independents, but 20 to 25% of white Democrats in those states said that they wouldn't vote for Obama based on his race. And they admitted it. So you have 20 to 25% of white Democrats admitting that they won't vote for Obama because of his race. Think about how many more won't, but won't admit it to a pollster. Think about how many more Republicans and independents, who I venture to say are on average more racist than your average Democrat, how many of them won't vote for him? So yes, I'm worried. I'm worried. When I endorsed Obama 6 months ago, has it really been 6 months? Maybe 5 months ago. When I endorsed Barack Obama, I saw him as the best candidate to beat John McCain. And I still do, sort of. I don't mean to back off too clearly, but I do. I saw him rising above race, above politics, talking about bringing America together. He was something different from the Clintons. And I liked Bill Clinton. I'm not one that's going to join trashing him. I do disagree with some of the tactics, some of the things he said in the campaign, just as I disagree with some of the things Hillary did in the campaign. But at rock bottom, while they are extremely ambitious people, while they certainly want to be president a lot, maybe too much, I think at the heart they want to change America for the good, both of them. And there's no question in my mind about that. Again, we can disagree on tactics, but I think at bottom they're good people. And it seems to me, though, that Barack Obama was aspiring to something higher than the Clintons, in America beyond politics. Because one of the things that the Clintons did was some of the close-to-call Rovian tactics to the Republican swift boat type tactics that are dirty and slimy and win elections. And part of me wanted to support Hillary Clinton because I felt that she would play dirty enough to win. I've never felt there was any terrific difference between Obama and Hillary Clinton on policy. I think they're actually very similar. If you look at their energy policy, I've admitted I prefer Hillary's health care policy. Hillary was wrong on Iraq, but they both want to bring the troops home now. I think on economic issues, the idea of tax cuts for middle class and lower class while making the wealthy pay their fair share. I mean, education, you just go down the line, the environment, they're both very, very, very close and very good people. So it was a question of style. It was a question of personality. I did think Obama was a bit less likely to be corrupted by special interests than Hillary Clinton. And I did think that his rhetoric soared above the mundane in a way that inspired lots of young people in a way that hers didn't. But the thing that's always been in the back of my mind is, will Barack Obama be tough enough? You know, I looked at Bill Clinton and I said, this is a man who knew how to play dirty. And sometimes, given, hey, I live here, I live in the Beltway, I live in Washington, D.C., I know how it works here. You got to play dirty sometimes to win. Not illegally, not unfairly, but rough. Because if you're boxing with someone and they're hitting you below the belt and you only hit above the belt in the chest, you're going to lose pretty quick. And I knew the Clintons could play rough. So part of me, before I endorsed Obama, 6 months ago, shall we say, I thought, you know, Hillary Clinton, she can play rough. Bill Clinton can play rough. We need to play rough. And that's why I had a difficult decision. Finally, I don't know, maybe it was Obama's rhetoric about hopes conquering fears, I decided to vote for the candidate that I was most inspired by. And that was Barack Obama. A candidate that, for all his imperfections and for all his newness, was someone who made America and Americans feel better about itself. A candidate that recognized that our hopes can trump our fears and that we don't want to be in a dirty politic land. And so this whole race to me is almost a battle between mind and heart, a battle between gut maybe and heart, because my gut says I've been in Washington long enough and I'm cynical enough to think only by playing rough can we win. And yet my heart and my soul says that's not the kind of America that I believe in. So I'll tell you one thing I am proud about, and I did see, as I'm sure most of you did, Barack Obama's speech last night. He's taken it to McCain. He's taken it hard to McCain, and he's taken it the right way. The right way. He's taken it to McCain on the issues. Lo and behold, that's what we're supposed to choose our president on, and that is what McCain is weak on. Because on the issues, he wants to do everything George Bush is doing. George, second lowest president approval rating in history, W. Bush. And I still think he can hit that first. He's only 4 points away from Nixon. Just 4 more points, and we got it. Worst president in history. I should have some music or something for that. But he took it to McCain on the issues. And McCain, knowing he's beat on the issues, is trying to go after Obama personally. And nowhere more was that clear was in their fight over the GI Bill. Now, here you have a fascinating thing. The Republicans say support our troops all the time, all the time. I played for you yesterday all the different quotes, and there's 1,000 more. Support the troops, support the troops. And for Republicans, support the troops means do whatever the president says, right? Support the troops means agree with the president's policy and don't question it. If the president says no body armor for the troops, well, then support the troops. Don't give them body armor. If the president says we have no post-invasion plan or everything's just fine, don't worry about it, then supporting the troops means agreeing with the president. That is the Republican definition of support the troops. Well, Obama's definition is different. He takes the definition of my Virginia senator, Jim Webb, who I've criticized on other issues, but he's dead right on this one. For him, supporting the troops means a new GI Bill, making a compact with those brave men and women that decide to serve their country, like the compact we made in World War II. In other words, if you're going to risk your life for your country, if you're going to risk your life to do what the president orders you to do, even when the president is a blooming idiot and you risk your life just because he gets some crazy message in his head, and yet you're willing to do that, to basically follow the craziness of a mad leader just because you believe in America and democracy, and, well, that's what our president says. Of course, this president wasn't elected, but that's another issue. For those brave men and women willing to take that risk, they should at least be able to go to college. I mean, after all, we don't have a draft anymore, and most of the people that join the military, I don't know, maybe half of them are doing it because they truly want to join the military and get out there and carry guns and kill people for their nation and defend their country. But a lot of people do it because, let's face it, they have no opportunities. We're in America where the poor are getting poorer and poorer every day. And the only way out of grinding poverty in America, and anyone will tell you this, is education. It's always been the only way. I mean, okay, 99%. You can get out because you're a terrific athlete or you're a terrific singer or actor, but those people are truly, truly rare. The main way out is education. And so the idea is that if you're going to serve your country, then you should be able to get into at least any state college you want to go to, all expenses paid. Now, this would seem to be a pro-veteran move. This would seem to be something that John McCain, who talks about his service all the time, would come around, would support. It's fascinating, because he doesn't. And not only does he not support allowing our GIs to go to college, but he criticizes Obama for being too pro-veteran. Now, he doesn't criticize him on the policy, of course. It's kind of hard to defend. McCain's view is that, well, because studies show that if you give college to veterans, that some more leave, but then some more come because they're attracted by the college. It happens to be in equal numbers. But therefore, you'll get more veterans that are only there 3 years instead of veterans that are there 5 years. And for this tiny little distinction, he would make sure that veterans can't make it, don't get an education, and as John Edwards pointed out, we end up with a lot of them sleeping under bridges. Well, Obama is more pro-veteran than McCain, so McCain pulled the veteran card. I served, you didn't, shut the up, I bleeped to myself. That's what McCain said to Obama. I served, you didn't, you have no right to comment, says John McCain after endorsing a man who himself shirked military service all because he was high on drugs and didn't want to show up for a National Guard blood test. So Obama responded last night in, I think, a brilliant fashion. He went right to the heart of what McCain was saying, right to the heart of the personal attacks that John McCain was doing, and stripped them bare. You know, it's amazing. If people whisper a personal attack or imply a personal attack, I think sometimes it goes into people's subconscious. You know, Obama didn't serve, McCain did serve, or McCain has a black baby, or John Kerry's medals may not have been justified. All these lies that are done in dirty politics. Obama said straight on, I respect John McCain's service even though he doesn't respect my accomplishments. And there was something about putting it right up there. You know, I treat my opponent with respect. John McCain isn't treating me with respect. He's a sore, whatever, player. I don't want to say winner or loser. I play fair, he plays unfair. That just brought it out of the daylight, took it out of the muck, brought it to the light of day, and I don't know, it made the cockroaches scurry away. I think he's doing a good job. Now, Hillary, I suspect by the end of the week, she will finally withdraw from the race and endorse Obama. It is to be pointed out, in her defense, that this race is the closest race in modern history in any primary. You look at the other close races, you know, Ronald Reagan and Gerald Ford, or it's hard to think of another one. That Kennedy and Carter was nowhere near this close. The races, I mean, Hillary Clinton, whatever her popular vote, got well over 49% of the Democrats who voted. So we have to give her due. And the thing that bothers me more than anything else is to hear from certain Obama supporters and certain Clinton supporters who are still wrapped up in what is already, as of last night, old news. There are still people on the Obama camp who are angry at things that Hillary Clinton said or did during the primary. And they may be right. They may be justified. I say let it go. There are still Clinton supporters that are angry over the treatment of Hillary Clinton, perhaps over what happened with Michigan and Florida, which was imperfect, no question about it. We can go into, well, you know, at the beginning she accepted it and then she switched. I don't need to. It's old news. Let it go. We've got to find a way to bring this party together. Now, I don't think that Obama should make Hillary Clinton his vice president, show nominee. If he does, I'm fine with that. I'll support the ticket. I'll very happily do it. I think Hillary Clinton would make a fine president. I don't think he'll do it, though. I think vice president has to play second fiddle, and with her and her the most famous vice presidential spouse ever, I don't see it happening. But there's definitely a role, and should be a role, for Hillary Clinton in an Obama administration. I wouldn't mind seeing her or Bill appointed to the United States Supreme Court, for example. They would be fine justices, in my view. I wouldn't mind seeing either of them be in Obama's cabinet. In fact, as I've said before, I actually like Hillary Clinton's health care plan better than Obama's. I'd love to have him work, have her work for him on that, though I don't think he'll choose her. So I was a mix of emotions last night. And to the women who are disappointed and to the men who are disappointed by the fact that there's not the first woman major party candidate yet, all I can say is that that time will come. That time will come. Nancy Pelosi has already broken through the second highest barrier. She is the most powerful woman in the United States. And the Speaker of the House is a very powerful position. And none of us should doubt that. Women will break through. And if it happens to be a woman who doesn't get there by virtue of the same last name as her husband, even better. Even better. The main thing, I think, for Obama supporters is to truly reach out. Not do it begrudgingly, but to follow Barack Obama's lead and reach out with an open hand, even when that hand is slapped away, to continue to reach out again and again and again to the Clinton supporters. I'd like to see Barack Obama go back to West Virginia, go back to Kentucky, go back to Pennsylvania, and go to small mountain towns and have a town hall meeting in some Appalachian place and let them see that, yeah, he's human, and he cares about them, and he cares about their needs. And he may have to do that. Go to small towns and win over her voters one by one by one by one. And I just think that's the right thing to do. He's got to reach out. He won. He's got to be bigger than her supporters. His supporters have to be bigger. It's easier to be a winner than a loser. And as much as a sore loser annoys us, a sore winner should annoy us more, because people who've won shouldn't be sore. So I hope if you know someone who's a diehard Clinton supporter, and I know several, that you will reach out to him or her with an open arm. And even if he or she complains about something Obama said or did, be gentle, watch your tone. It's old news. We won. Obama is the nominee. So concede what you need to. Don't lie, but don't get in these old battles. It's simply not worth it. We've got to move on. We've got to defeat John McCain. If you want to call in, folks, and agree or disagree with anything I've said today, please do so, or raise any issue of your own. I want to move on to other topics as well. But, of course, you know the toll-free number, 877-4-HEAD-ON. 877-443-2366. You want to comment on the Obama-Clinton race? I'm always glad to hear from you. Or we can talk about anything else that's in the news. There are other things that are in the news. One of the things that I haven't talked about at length is the Scott McClellan book. And what's fascinating about him more than anything else is how it's not news anymore. You know, when I first came on the air 5 years ago, and I did my very first show in June 2003, heck, now that I think about it, next week will be, or 2 weeks from now will be my 5 year anniversary. On, I'll have to let you know when my 5 year anniversary is. Well, we'll have to do something special to celebrate. Maybe I'll play clips from my first show. But when I first came on the air 5 years ago, and I said things like George Bush is hiding information that shows that people are planning attacks against the United States. He's actually taking terrorist attack information and not giving it to governors and mayors who could use it to protect our cities because he wants to use it for political reasons, which was my first inside scoop back in June 03. And then in my next week and the week after that, when I talked about cherry-picking intelligence, I talked about fixing the facts around the intelligence. This was before the Downing Street memo. This was before Scott McClellan, before Colin Powell, before all the tell-all books. And I was just basing it on my sources, some named, mostly unnamed. At that time, people were truly skeptical. They couldn't believe that a president would lie to get us into war. The most skeptical people, it seems, were those that thought with me that there weren't any WMDs, but even they didn't believe the administration was intentionally lying about it. There was, of course, the 20% of Americans, including, I'm sure, everyone listening to my voice now, that believed that Bush was lying all along. But a good 80% supported the president. This was the time, you got to remember, when Hillary Clinton authorized the war, at a time when America generally trusts their president. And I think America should generally trust their president. As Ronald Reagan said, trust but verify. Believe but check it out. Anyway, when I came on the air 5 years ago and said these kinds of things, at the time, people just didn't believe me, thought I was some crazy conspiracy theorist. Then we had book after book after book after book. Richard Clark was one of the early ones. Paul O'Neill, former Treasury Secretary. Colin Powell and his chief of staff, Larry Wilkerson, who's been on my show. Person after person after person. And now, after the Downing Street memo, after we know now that, yes, they were torturing people, and yes, they were wiretapping people, and yes, even Ashcroft had problems with it, and yes, Jim Comey caught Gonzalez trying to, you know, force the Attorney General to break the law. Now that all this is old news, and Scooter Libby was ordered by Dick Cheney, the Vice President of the United States, to commit treason, that is old news. Now comes Scott McCallum and tells us everything that I said, that all these other people have said for many years now. And the irony of this whole thing is that people are yawning. They don't care anymore. I mean, isn't that strange to you? At the beginning, at the time it happened, people just denied it. They said, you know, you're crazy. That's just some leftist conspiracy. Some disgruntled employee, they called Richard Clark. In fact, Scott McClellan called Richard Clark a disgruntled employee. And now, when they call Scott McClellan a disgruntled employee, well, we all laugh. Because it's old news. Because even the Republicans know it's old news. George Bush ran out the clock. He ran out the clock. At this point, pretty much everyone knows he should be impeached. But hey, you know, we got a new president in a few months, so we'll just move on. What did Scott McClellan say? Well, if he'd said it in 03, it would have been astonishing. When I said it in 03, people, as I said, didn't believe me, and I didn't have enough of a media outlet to get the word out a lot beyond the Washington area. But today, it's old news. What did he say? Well, there's a permanent campaign in the Bush White House. That's something Scott McClellan could not get enough of saying. There is a permanent political campaign. And this permanent political campaign makes sure that every single thing they do is done through the lens of what can help them politically. The irony of all of this, of course, is that we have the second lowest rated president since Richard Nixon right before he was impeached by the House Judiciary Committee and thrown out of office. And yet, that's what they did. McClellan talks about a political propaganda campaign in favor of the Iraq War. Well, duh. The fact that the president was determined to go to war in Iraq, even when he argued that he was still looking at other options. Well, duh. He talks about the fact that during Hurricane Katrina, the president punted. He just kind of thought that it wouldn't be so bad, and so, well, he really wasn't that concerned about it, and he just kind of hoped it would go away. Well, duh. Here's a quote from the book, Scott McClellan. We set up a massive political operation that was aimed at really continuing that permanent campaign way of governing. He talked about selling the war. That it was all about selling the war. And now, how have Republicans responded to him? Disgruntled ex-employee. They're not even trying anymore. They're simply saying the exact same kinds of things. Dana Perino, the new press secretary, said, well, you know, if he had concerns, he should have approached us. He should have told us. That's hilarious, given that anyone who approaches the Bush administration with concerns is fired, as was Paul O'Neill, as was Richard Clark, as was currently a judge overseeing the Guantanamo trials. a judge who insisted that, hey, the defendant deserves due process under the Constitution. Well, you mention Constitution to George Bush, and you get fired. Now, it's obvious why Scott McClellan didn't say anything, but no, they're the Republicans. He's stabbing him in the back, and no one knows why, said Trent Duffy, who works for Scott McClellan. No one knows why. Of course, the main thing that made Scott McClellan mad was the fact that he lied so clearly to all of us when he told us that Rove and Libby knew nothing about leaking the name of CIA agent Valerie Plame. He said that Rove and Libby looked him in the eye and told him they had nothing to do with it. Seems that was true, even though what he told us was a lie. There are other things to talk about. I want to get out my thoughts and also give you a chance to call in and tell me what you have in mind, what's on your mind. So whether it's Obama or McClellan or anything else, feel free to pick up the phone and dial 877-4-HEAD-ON, 877-443-2366. We'll be right back after this.
I'm Matt Rothschild, the editor of the Progressive magazine, with my progressive point of view, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org. The moment called for graciousness. Hillary Clinton didn't answer the call. The moment called for a modicum of class. None was to be found, except for a feint at the beginning when Senator Clinton said she was congratulating Senator Obama and his supporters on the race they've run. It was as if Obama had lost and Clinton, the winner, was just being magnanimous. In long passages of her speech, it seemed like she was living in a parallel universe where the news had not yet arrived that the race was over and that she actually wasn't going to be the Democratic nominee. For there she was, inexplicably still arguing that she was the strongest candidate, the one who will be ready to take back the White House and take charge as Commander-in-Chief and lead our country to better tomorrows. Earth to Hillary, you lost! And these comments aren't helpful to Barack Obama's cause, echoing as they do your charge earlier in the campaign that McCain is ready to be Commander-in-Chief, but Obama is not. Never having given a proper concession speech all primary season long, Hillary Clinton didn't start now. And so she's leaving the campaign just as she conducted it all along, arrogantly, shamelessly, disgracefully. I'm Matt Rothschild, and that's how I see it.
From Washington, more of the Inside Scoop with Mark Levine.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. There's all kinds of things going on, and if you want to comment on any of them, I encourage you to do so. This is a good show for that, sort of talking about odds and ends. Toll-free number is 877-4-HEAD-ON, 877-443-2366. I noticed a comment by Powerpuff in the chat room mentioning in Obama's speech how he responded to McCain on Iraq, that she liked that response. I liked it, too. You probably know that McCain has been on Obama saying, well, you haven't been to Iraq in the past 2 years. His spokesman was saying, there could be a baby 2 years old in Iraq that has never been there since Obama set foot in the country. As if that matters in any sense at all. I thought that was the weirdest thing around. But, of course, Obama replied, you know, John McCain, I haven't been to Iraq in 2 years. Maybe you should... while I'm in Iraq, maybe you should visit Michigan and Florida and Kentucky and Ohio and places where people are suffering. You want me to go to Iraq? I'd like you to see Michigan. That was a good line, and I think Powerpuff is right to bring that up. Other things going on. Well, there was a hearing in Washington that got very little attention. It's one of the things I like to bring up is things that don't get much attention, where they brought in all the executives of all the oil companies and asked them how much they made. One of the real advantages, one of the most important advantages to having the Democrats control Congress, of course, is their ability to call in and subpoena people and bring them to hearings. Now, whenever people in the administration are subpoenaed, the administration unlawfully and unconstitutionally, says, no, we're not showing up, because if we were to tell you the truth, you'd realize how incompetent we are and corrupt we are, and we can't possibly allow that. But they can still subpoena the oil company execs. And it was fun when Senator Judiciary Chairman Patrick Leahy asked ConocoPhillips executive John Lowe how much he made. He said, I don't know the exact amount, said the executive head of ConocoPhillips. Leahy asked, is it more than $100,000 a year? Yes, sir. Is it considerably over $100,000 a year? Yes, it would be. Is it over $1 million a year? Actually, it was $16.9 million, as it turns out. But the executive says, yes, it's over $1 million. Is it over $2 million? Yes. Is it over $3 million? Yes. Is it over $4 million? And the executive said, I don't remember. He doesn't remember? He got $16.9 million last year, and he doesn't remember whether it was over $4 million or not? Well, as Patrick Leahy, Senator Leahy said, you know, if I made over $4 million a year, I probably wouldn't remember either. For all that Republicans talk about the fact that the super rich need more tax cuts, I think all they have to do is remind themselves that the CEOs don't even know whether they make $16 million or $4 million. You could tax this guy at 75%, and he wouldn't know this is the difference. Right? $16 million, 75% of that is $4 million. It's all the same to him, $4 million, $16 million. Proof that the rich don't notice tax cuts up as high as 75%. Then, of course, came Stephen Simon of ExxonMobil. He admitted to being paid as much as $12.5 million. Turns out he gets $32.7 million when you include his options. But the executives didn't seem to think that, their salaries had anything to do with the oil crisis. There is another one, Robertson, I forget what he was CEO of, but he made $28.4 million. And, you know, they could point out, look, their salaries are a very small portion of their company's profits. ExxonMobil made $40 billion last year, the highest that any company has ever made in any country in the history of the world. That $40 billion was not receipts, wasn't revenues, it was profits, pure profits. And Americans are complaining about $4 gasoline? How else are these executives going to make the $16 million that they can't count high enough if you don't fill up your tanks? What fascinates me about all of this is that now, it seems, that the media is shocked to learn that Americans are starting to look at the cost of oil. And they're thinking, well, maybe I will get that Prius. And maybe I won't get that Hummer. Maybe I do need to look at a smaller car. Maybe I need to look at public transportation, which is up 10%. All because the price of oil went up. Now, I remember the election of 1980. In fact, it's really the first election that I followed. I was still just a kid in grammar school. But I remember because you had Carter and Reagan and John Anderson. And I was a big supporter of independent John Anderson at the time. And John Anderson's signature idea was to put a 50 cent a gallon a gas tax on gasoline. Now, at the time, gas was under a dollar, I think. God, hard to believe that's true. So that was a significant, you know, bump up. That was maybe 50% of the cost. It'd be like a $2 a gallon tax today. And the money would go into things like public transportation and things like making the, you know, cars more fuel efficient, things like what would become the Prius or become the Brazilian fleet of sugarcane vehicles. And people laughed and laughed at the stupidity of an independent candidate proposing something so ridiculous as a 50-cent-a-gallon tax on gasoline. And what have we learned? We've learned that yes, when gas prices go up, guess what? People conserve. People use public transportation. People look for cars with lower fuel mileage. So now we've come to a point where gas has not gone up 50 cents. Gas has gone up more than $3. And the money isn't going to the government. The money is going to oil companies and to Arab dictators who then use it to finance Al-Qaeda and other terrorist groups. So instead of our government getting the excess money and using it to finance public transportation, to finance, to use incentives to convince motor cars companies to create vehicles that have higher fuel mileage, the money goes to our enemies, whether they be oil companies or Arab dictators. And it's six times the money. And lo and behold, it's having the intended effect. I like higher gas prices if the government gets the money, because it encourages us finally to conserve. It encourages us finally to use public transportation to get to Priuses and hybrid vehicles and so forth. But that, if the government gets the money, it can refund it back to the people so they don't suffer. Because I don't want people to suffer. It's hard on people. You could give it back as a tax rebate if you wanted to, if the government was taking in the money. Now, we have the worst of both worlds. We have the higher gas prices. We have Detroit, which didn't prepare for smaller cars. Europe did. Japan did. South America did. Brazil did. Nope. Detroit built Hummers. Ronald Reagan became president, and Detroit said, we don't have to worry about oil. And now we're spending $3 trillion in the country with the second largest oil supplies on earth, as our president begs the country with the largest oil supplies on earth to please lower gas just a little bit. A country that happens to mistreat women more than any other on earth, Saudi Arabia. So we have the higher gas prices. We have the war in Iraq. And none of the money is going to public transportation or getting us off of the oil addiction. But, hey, if you're an Exxon stockholder, you're doing well. So that's good for you. Still, we have no one wanting to pay for the war. I mentioned the cost of the war at $3 trillion. You probably didn't hear about another bill that came before Congress that those of us inside the Beltway know about, but you may not know outside the Beltway. And that is a bill, the one that would increase educational benefits for returning veterans, the GI Bill. The thing the Republicans most didn't like about it was there would be a small tax on couples earning more than $1 million a year. Individuals earning more than $500,000 a year would have their taxes increased by 0.5%. How many American taxpayers earn more than $500,000 a year? Well, I'll give you a hint. 99.7% don't. 0.3% earn that amount. And that amount, that group of people, the people who make, the couples who make more than $1 million a year, each individual got more than $126,000 from the Bush tax cuts. And they would have to pay some $8,000 in order to help the veterans. So now I want you to think about this. The veterans are risking their lives. They're putting their lives on the line for a preemptive war that many of them didn't want to go to in the first place. A lot of my friends that joined the military did so to fight Al-Qaeda, to fight Afghanistan, to fight the Taliban, the country and the terrorist group that murdered 3,000 Americans. They're sent to Iraq. They're risking their lives on a country and a group and a people that never attacked us. And in order to deny them educational benefits, not even to allow them to go to college, Republicans are standing firm. Because people that made over $125,000 on Bush tax cuts alone don't want to give $8,000 of it back. They made $126,000 and they don't want to only make $118,000. Now, this isn't extra work they did. This is simply by virtue of the changes in the Bush tax code. recalling that, of course, in the Clinton years, the rich got richer. They did significantly better in the Clinton years, so did the middle class and the poor. So because those that earned $126,000 don't want to only earn $118,000 for doing nothing, our veterans won't be able to go to college. We'll have homeless veterans under bridges. One of the amazing things about the war in Iraq is not that it's just stupid and murderous and killing hundreds of thousands of Iraqis and thousands of Americans and tens of thousands wounding vets. It's not just that. It's that the Republicans don't even want to pay for it. You know, if you believe in something firmly, you should be willing to pay for it. I myself would be willing to pay higher taxes to fight the Taliban in Afghanistan. I'll tell you, I would be willing to pay higher taxes to capture Osama bin Laden, to bring him to trial and to execute him. I would. I like to think that had I been living in the 40s, I would have been willing to pay higher taxes to pay for World War II. In fact, Americans didn't complain when we taxed people as high as 90% for the top bracket in World War II. There are wars worth fighting. I would pay higher taxes to send troops in Darfur to stop the genocide. I didn't support the war in Iraq. I never did. But for the Republicans who supported the war in Iraq, how come they don't want to be taxed to pay for it? That's how you know they really don't support it. That's how you know that it's really just lip service and a way to funnel a bunch of money to Halliburton and oil companies. If they supported it, they'd be willing to pay for it. I'm willing to support and pay for the wars that I support. I'd be willing to be taxed more to pay for our GIs to get a decent education. I'd be willing to be taxed to do things to fight global warming or provide better education or to raise teacher pay. There are things I'd be willing to be taxed for. Well, Republicans, if you love the war in Iraq so much, if you want to have the troops there 100 years, John McCain, then how about paying for it? Why do you love debt so much? Only because you can use it to trick Americans into thinking that there's no cost to this war. Other things I've been reading about inside the Beltway, one of them has to do with my favorite topic, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. You know, as a lawyer, as a ex-congressional lawyer, there's a certain pain that I feel that goes right to the heart when I see lawyers deserting their country, deserting the law, and twisting language so it no longer means anything anymore. And, of course, the person who does this more than any other is John Yoo, my classmate at Yale Law School. John Yoo wrote a memo on the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act that has just come to light. I was saying years ago that they were doing this, but I hadn't seen the memo yet. Well, let me tell you about this memo. The Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, as you recall, was passed in the 1970s to end some of the abuses of the past before then, to end some of the abuses of J. Edgar Hoover's FBI. Recall that he was spying on Martin Luther King, spying on him because he disagreed with civil rights. He didn't want to see King succeed. So he spied on him, couldn't ever prove that King was a communist, which is what Hoover was trying to prove, but did find some marital indiscretions and definitely used those against King. Well, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act was designed to say, now wait a minute, we do need to be able to spy on some people, it's true, but we want to respect the Constitution, we want to use warrants to do so. And we want to make sure that the president isn't spying on his political opponents, right? I mean, that's why Nixon was thrown out of office, right? He broke in, well, he covered up the break-in of the Watergate headquarters of the Democratic National Committee. He covered up that break-in. And what was the goal of the break-in? To get information on the president's political opponents. So the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act is there. It's got a secret court. It's all done in quiet. They approve 99.9% of the warrants. By the way, that's not an exaggeration. It's actually higher than that. They can do it in secret. But the one thing that we agreed on in the bill was despite the fact that this was a secret court that could approve warrants 99.9% of the time, that you could even go and spy on people, get retroactive approval 48 hours later, at the very least, the one thing we could agree on is that it was the exclusive means by which to do surveillance. And that is a direct quote from the bill, by the way. The Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act says it is, quote, the exclusive means by which electronic surveillance and the interception of domestic, wire, oral, and electronic communications may be conducted. That's strong legal language. It is the exclusive means by which electronic surveillance and intercepting domestic, wire, oral, electronic communications may be conducted. In other words, you can only spy on people through this law. No other way. It is exclusive. Now, that's the kind of legal language that, I'm sorry, it's bulletproof. There's nothing you can do to get out of that. Mr. President, if you want to spy on us, you go get a warrant. And if you can't do it openly in court, you do it secretly before the secret court, but you got to get a warrant. Well, John Yoo's memo has just come to the public attention. And he wrote, quote, unless Congress made a clear statement in the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act that it sought to restrict presidential authority to conduct warrantless searches in the national security area, then the statute must be construed to avoid such a reading. Unquote. Translation. Even though FISA, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, even though it said that the president can exclusively do it this way, unless it specifically said that the president can't do it without a warrant in wartime, well then, of course he can do it without a warrant in wartime. Got it? If the law says that the president can exclusively, nuke a country by going through procedures, by pushing this button and calling this person and declaring nuclear war and so forth, and that's the exclusive way, but it doesn't rule out calling his mom and having his mother call his granddaughter and having her put the baby on the line and having the baby nuke Russia. Well, we can still do it that way. In other words, according to John Yoo, exclusive doesn't mean exclusive unless you specifically exclude all other possibilities. According to John Yoo, exclusive means it's not exclusive at all. According to John Yoo, it's exclusive, but not if you don't exclude the president, putting a monkey on the line, and that's okay, or spying on someone using special glasses, or satellites, or... John Yoo is in effect saying that the law means nothing at all. Absolutely nothing. It's not exclusive, because it says exclusive, so it can't be exclusive. And if you haven't followed what I've said, that's part of the problem. The law is so bulletproof that he had to basically lie about it. Now, we've learned from Scott McClellan that the FBI had put together a war crimes file. That because of the torture being approved at the highest levels, where they literally overruled Attorney General John Ashcroft, who I got lots of problems with, but even Ashcroft was opposed to this, and they overruled him. And as I pointed out on my show, there are not too many people that can overrule John Ashcroft. Pretty much it's only the president. Maybe the vice president if given power by the president. That because of this, the FBI started setting up war crimes trials. War crimes files for war crimes trials for the president and vice president of the United States. Well, I know who I want to be the first to try on my war crimes tribunal. My ex-Yale Law School classmate, John Yoo. I want to see him explain why the word exclusive doesn't mean exclusive. For all the attacks on Bill Clinton for not knowing what the definition of the word is, I wonder if John Yoo can say what the definition of exclusive is. For him, it excludes nothing lawless. Hope you enjoyed the show today. Tomorrow, I'm having Bishop Harry Jackson on the air. He is a very interesting character. He's an